You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, October 6, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, look ahead at the high-stakes cases for this year's Supreme Court term. Mark Joseph Stern, staff writer at Slate. Meanwhile, will the Senate create a filibuster carve-out for the debt ceiling? Then if so, how is that even possible? U.S. COVID cases and deaths on decline. Meanwhile, top experts want to scale back the Biden administration boosters plan. This is a heartwarming story. Merck will sell its federally financed COVID drug for seven times its cost. England's maskless schools, leading to a COVID surge among students. 1,400 Kellogg cereal factory workers on strike in four cities around the country. New report, climate change has caused destruction of 14% of the world's coral in just the last 10 years. Ernst Johnson executed in Missouri despite questions of his mental capacity. 25 days out from reconciliation deadline, the Biden administration is debating what to slash when they build back better-ish plan. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. It is, as we have coined it around here, Hump Day. It seems to be catching on. I'm joined on this Wednesday by Emma Vigeland, as I am on the other 5 days of the week that I'm even here.
Right. Well, right. Which is not 5 days.
I mean, from a technical standpoint, that's correct.
Technically, I'm accurate. Yes.
And technically, yes.
Technically.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And also, not so technically, you're accurate.
I'm accurate in every way. One could be accurate.
I came into the office today, as you know, Emma, mm-hmm. on a bit of a high because the Red Sox beat the Yankees last night. Yes. I should also say I got a text from Lawyer Matthew, who, you know, our longtime listeners may be aware of. He's was a longtime IMer. He's been a little bit busy as of late. And he, of course, is very, very interested in the Supreme Court. He mm-hmm. thinks that's one of the most important things in our politics, which I tend to agree, at least in this context. And he was upset that because he's a diehard Yankees fan, we've gone back and forth with this over the years, and he felt like I had purposely scheduled something about the Supreme Court
today, right?
So that he has to listen.
He has to tune in. What? Yep. What he should be doing all the time.
He should be doing all the time. But this was a no miss for him. He definitely would have stayed away to hear me.
You gotta say go Sox.
I'm about to go Sox. And
but not,
boy, they just destroyed the last.
Yeah, night. It didn't look competitive at all. No Massachusetts accent that you're gonna.
That's all right. I mean, people can get it. It's implied. It's implied.
Yeah, but I wanted to hear it.
But go Sox.
Yes.
Freaking unbelievable last night. Sorry. It looks like the judge got dismissed from his own case last night. Yeah. I hadn't prepped that
one. You need to workshop that.
But I got to work that one out. But he got thrown out of home. So, judge got disbarred.
That's better.
Oh, thanks. I'll work on those. But my point being that I came in this morning and I was in a good mood, a very good mood. And the more I think about what seems to be a complete absence of strategy on this debt ceiling thing. I mean, look, you know, there are Democrats can't control these things necessarily. I should say they can't control what the Republicans do. Completely predictable what Mitch McConnell was going to do in terms of the debt ceiling for two reasons. One, because we have years and years of evidence of how Mitch McConnell does things. And the other piece of evidence was that as early as like 6 months ago, Mitch McConnell was making it absolutely clear, we're not going to vote to raise the debt ceiling. Period. End of story. The Democrats are going to have to do it on their own. Now, you would think at that moment, people who are in the leadership of the Democratic Party, specifically in the Senate, where this is a problem. Mitch McConnell says he's not going to vote for it. That's a problem in the Senate because there's a filibuster. You would think that the leader of the Democrats in the Senate would just take, 10, 15, 20 minutes, sit down with a piece of paper and a pen, maybe have one or two of his aides around and say, like, what's the plan for this? Should we come up with a plan? Let's write down the plan. Then let's try and execute the plan. There seems to be a complete absence of a plan here.
And it's coming soon, the deadline. The United States is going to default on its debt if nothing is done. The debt will break the statutory ceiling on the 18th. And that's like not... If they don't get reconciliation the process of reconciliation started yesterday or today at the very least, that's not going to happen through reconciliation.
And the thing is, it could... But they're choosing not to do this for whatever reason. Somehow they think this is, I don't even know the constituency that they think is that it's going to have any political resonance with anybody.
Hypocrisy shaming Mitch McConnell on the debt ceiling, right? Like, oh, you raised it this trillion under Trump and we helped you and now you won't raise it now and the collective populace in the United States is going to sleep.
I don't even think the people who are really the most sensitive to this issue even like, you know.
Yeah.
They're like, well, just go and mint the coin or do reconciliation.
Yeah.
But Joe Biden and the Democrats are it seems that it's not enough for them to quixotically try and score points off of Mitch McConnell being Mitch McConnell. Now it seems that they want to basically also shoot themselves in the foot with their own party. Here is Joe Biden yesterday answering questions from the South Lawn of the White House. And this is, it's not just Joe Biden. I mean, there's apparently talk about this and I don't understand. I don't understand what it is they're trying to communicate here. Here is Joe Biden.
Is it in a reconciliation bill?
Are you okay? Progressives want it in there, but Joe Manchin has said he does not want it in there.
I want to get the bill passed.
So how would you sign it if the Hyde Amendment is included?
I'd sign it either way. Because the Hyde Amendment is... Anyway.
What do you think is going to be cut from the final bill now that they're disagreed upon?
Oh, I'm not sure yet. It's not finished yet.
Are Democrats considering using a nuclear option to raise the debt limit? Using a carve-out with the filibuster to raise the debt limit?
Oh, I think that's a real possibility.
Mr. President, are you meeting with other groups of lawmakers this week? Will you be meeting with more lawmakers, with more
yes.
Democrats?
I'll be on the phone, so this is
no need to hear anymore. And that's the part that I want to hear. Are Democrats contemplating a carve-out of the filibuster to raise the debt ceiling? And Joe Biden's response isn't, we could never do that. The filibuster is sacrosanct.
I got to check with the legal experts about
it. I'm not sure what the... Can we do that? I don't think so. Because, hey, come on, man. It's the Senate. We don't do that. It's sacrosanct.
Never mind.
You can't ruin
anyway.
You can't ruin the the norms. I mean, think about what's communicated here. What's communicated here is, despite the fact that we have other vehicles to raise the debt ceiling, including a new reconciliation bill, the existing reconciliation bill, the minting of a multi-trillion dollar coin or a trillion dollar platinum coin, which is, you know, sort of, it's sort of half a joke, but you can do it. But what it does is it illustrates that this is all made up anyways.
Well, the whole thing's a joke.
Exactly.
Like, even the stuff that's treated with artificial seriousness is a joke.
The existence of the debt ceiling in and of itself is also...
Reconciliation is a joke. The filibuster's a joke.
Well, I'm talking about the fiat currency. I mean, reconciliation is a mechanism that they've developed, whatever. They want to buy into that. The filibuster is a mechanism that they have. But the idea that we don't have the capacity to deal with this in other ways is a complete fiction. And I understand why they don't want to, why they don't want to do this. They don't want to show that there aren't the constraints that are used as a justification for not spending on other things. I mean, what would Joe Manchin say right now if everyone knew what the reality was, which is that we are not constrained by the deficit? We are not constrained by the debt. The debt is just on a balance sheet. There is nobody out there who's going to come and repossess our country. It just doesn't, that's not the way it works. We have a fiat currency. But the point is that if they are willing to get rid of the filibuster to protect that fiction, but they're not willing to do it to allow people to have the right to vote, to reestablish the Voting Rights Act, which has been hacked at by the Supreme Court, that they're not, they can't touch the filibuster to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour. They can't touch the filibuster to deal with immigration. They can't touch the filibuster to deal with expansion of Medicaid, the expansion of Medicare.
PRO Act.
The PRO Act.
Police reform.
I mean, we can go on and on and on that they are saying that protecting this fiction about our debt. There's a reason why this vote has been pro forma in the past. It's because it's not real. It is a artificial construct to create a false idea of scarcity so that we cannot provide for our people in this country.
And McConnell is banking on their adherence to that fiction, right? Because he wants to tank the Biden presidency and Biden agenda. And what would happen if the United States were to default on its debt, right? The value of U.S. Treasury bonds would completely just sink, which would tank the global economy, including the U.S. economy. There's estimates that unemployment would immediately rise by double what it is at right now. There's a variety of factors that would play entirely into the Republicans' hands electorally. So, like, this is actually an existential question for the Democrats, though. These kinds of Democrats who are obsessed with process and everything that you're saying and maintaining a fiction, are you more committed to maintaining that fiction than you are to saving your own ass?
Yeah, but the thing is, there is not going to be any default. That's the thing, is that there's too many other mechanisms that they can use. I mean, if they haven't figured this out by October 18th, the Treasury's going to come out and go like, you know, we actually found another thing that we can do, another extraordinary measure, and we can do this October 25th.
I know, but my point is that this is the kind of prospect and something that Democrats would actually be genuinely worried about that McConnell is using as leverage.
I'm not sure exactly what McConnell's agenda is, other than just like create havoc and watch these inept politicians try and do something with it. I think he just realizes like he is playing against the Washington Generals, And so it really doesn't matter what he does, because they're going to bump into each other. They're going to, end up spraining all their ankles on the court. He doesn't have to do anything. He just has to cause a problem and watch how ineptly they deal with this. Because Joe Biden saying that they can get rid of the filibuster, all of a sudden that it's a real prospect. Does he not realize that he's been treating this like it was, the
inevitable,
the shroud of Turin or whatever it is, like that? The filibuster is some untouchable. To just sort of like for them to be bandering it around when there is clearly other mechanisms in which to deal with the debt ceiling, unlike voting rights, unlike immigration reform, unlike on and on and on, all of these priorities, the PRO Act, whatever it is. And they don't realize, like, they're politicians. This is political. And it's almost as if they're like, oh, well, they're playing. It's almost, they think they have an audience of like 15 people. It's really sort of stunning. I mean, a measure of incompetence. It really is just crazy. I hope they get rid of the filibuster for the debt ceiling. And then I hope they get rid of it for other things. But I'm not convinced that Mitch McConnell's out there going like, I'm going to force them to get rid of the filibuster. And I don't have to worry about it, because Joe Manchin's already promised us that he's not going to vote for anything that they want. And we're going to take the Senate in 16 months, and we'll have no filibuster. And we're going to be able to blame, Joe Biden for getting rid of it. And the idea that people are going to say, well, we had to because of the debt ceiling, this is going to be a joke.
No one will care.
No one's going to care.
Yeah.
I'd still support Biden getting rid of it to the extent he does, though.
I say get rid of it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
I say get rid
Not
of it.
Not a carve out.
And if this provides a slippery slope to getting rid of the filibuster, even if it ends up being used, or the absence of the filibuster being used by Mitch McConnell in a Republican Senate in 2 years, good. The American public needs to, like, there needs to be less mystification around all of people's positions, so that it can be quite clear as to who people are voting for.
Although Republicans, they take the Senate, they get rid of the filibuster, and then before the next midterms, they reinstate it.
I mean,
that's why Democrats.
No, that's when Chris Coons. That's when Chris Coons announces, if we retake the Senate, the first thing we're going to do is reinstate the filibuster and try and get back to norms. All right, we got to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Mark Joseph Stern about some of the key Supreme Court cases that are coming up. Folks, today's show sponsored by one of my favorite sponsors. Last night, I gave a gift. It's not a big gift. It was like, a friend of mine was going on a trip, and there was a little bit of anxiety associated with that trip. And I was like, take this bottle of 750 milligram CBD tincture.
We got this tincture right here.
That's the one, melatonin.
Right. I know. I use that to sleep.
Yes. I was going to say, you don't want to do that during the show.
No, I'm bringing it home.
SunsetLakeCBD.com, as I forgot my other sign, has tinctures, has salves with arnica, has hand lotion, has fantastic coffee. It's my weekend brew that has CBD in it, fudge, gummies, smokables. Matt's holding on to a big thing of Keith that apparently he's going to put into his coffee. Is that what you do?
That's not what I'm doing with it, but that's what they suggested.
It is 100% pesticide free. They use integrated pest management, organic grown. You can check their website. They give you, every time you you purchase your product, you can find out exactly what its contents are. It's been tested by a third party. They work with the University of Vermont. Their agriculture practices are scrupulously designed to protect the environment and protect the soil. They have great business practices, $15 minimum wage. Most of the company is employee owned. They are great movement partners. contributed not only to our Afghan refugee drive the other day, I guess a couple of weeks ago now. They've supported the Worcester nurses on strike, things around their community. It is a great company, and it's a great product. I certainly was, and Matt was, Zebede skeptics. And I have to say, I rely on it to sleep occasionally, like at the end of the night, just sort of like as a, oh, maybe we'll try one of the smokables. It really is a great product, and we've gotten so much great feedback and so many return customers to their site. And that is what makes me that makes me happy, because it, it means that people are appreciating it.
Stuff you can just get at the corner store for Zebede is not sometimes it's just not good. It's not good.
You just
most of the time it's not, honestly. You've got to source it well.
I think so. And if you head over to sunsetlakezebede.com, use the coupon code LEFTISBEST. LEFTISBEST. One word, LEFTISBEST. You get 20% off. Check it out right now. Go to sunsetlakezebede.com, and LEFTISBEST gets you 20% off. Thank you for their sponsorship. Okay, want to welcome back to the program staff writer at Slate.com, Mark Joseph Stern. Mark, welcome. I'm here with Emma Vigeland.
Hi, Sam. Hi, Emma. Happy to be back.
Hi, Mark.
So, okay, new term, Supreme Court. This is dramatically different than, I think, like, really any term that we've had maybe in the past 20 years, because we have a really clear, there is no, to the extent that there's a swing vote, I guess always hypothetically there is a swing vote, but a swing vote really doesn't matter for the large part, right? Like, we have 6-3, and it, I don't think it's been like this at least in 20 years.
Not really since the 1930s, actually, when the Supreme Court repeatedly struck down New Deal legislation that FDR had passed. Not since then has there been a 6-justice conservative majority on the court. And you're right that there is no swing vote. The term I like to use is median justice. So if you line them all up by ideology, Justice Brett Kavanaugh would be the median justice. He is the sort of moderate, though not moderate, justice who holds a lot of the power, because now Chief Justice Roberts might as well be one of the liberals. He's been sidelined and his vote doesn't matter that much anymore.
That's an insane
It's terrifying.
It's terrifying.
It's terrifying. And, you know, right now, it seems to me, with what Breyer is doing, the prospect of a 7-2 court seems almost as likely as maintaining a 6-3 court at this point.
Yeah, so I think if a Democratic senator from a red state got hit by a car tomorrow and the Senate flipped into Republican hands and Breyer retired at the end of this term, I would put a lot of money on Mitch McConnell not allowing Joe Biden to fill that seat. I genuinely do not believe that a Republican-controlled Senate will ever again allow a Democratic president to appoint either Supreme Court justices or federal appeals court judges, which was the rule that McConnell essentially established in Obama's last 2 years. So the possibility of a 7-2 court is not remote, and the prospect should be very chilling to us all.
And we should say, like, I mean, I don't know how, like, any future Republican leader in the Senate could actually allow it being judged against McConnell's standard, right? Because honestly, like, they'll get torn to shreds by, you know, AM talk radio and Fox and OWN and whatever it is. I mean, all right, so with that horrific sort of baseline to start with, let's talk about some of the major cases that are going to come up in front of the court. I'm thinking we've got Roe v. Wade is on it. We have a major Second Amendment law that, or I should say a ruling, and there's also a challenge to Chevron that is potentially there, the Chevron doctrine. You choose the order in which you want to talk about those, because I mean, I guess Roe v. Wade is almost the one that's most obvious on the block.
Yeah, I think this term will probably be remembered as the term that the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. There's a case arising out of Mississippi that is a challenge to the state's 15-week abortion ban. And the state of Mississippi actually brought this case to the Supreme Court saying, hey, we just want to move back the line where when states can ban abortion. Right now it's at viability, which is about 24 weeks. Mississippi said, we just want to move it back to 15 weeks. The Supreme Court took up the case, and then Mississippi came back and said, ignore what we said before. Never mind. Now we just want you to overturn Roe v. Wade so we can ban abortion outright, and every other state that wants to can ban abortion. And I think that will prove to be a successful strategy. You know, Chief Justice Roberts seems to be a swing vote on abortion, but like we were saying earlier, his vote doesn't really matter, right? Brett Kavanaugh is the one who matters here. And he has never voted to block an abortion restriction in his career. To the contrary, he auditioned for the Supreme Court by continually voting to force a pregnant, undocumented minor to carry her unwanted pregnancy to term in a shelter in Texas. He is very, very anti-abortion. And I do think that he will cast the fifth vote to abolish the viability rule established in Roe, allow Mississippi to implement this 15-week ban, and in the process, effectively, if not formally, overturn Roe by saying, you know, there's no viability line anymore. States can declare open season on abortion, not just 15 weeks, but 12, 8, 6, 0, pretty much within weeks or months of a decision. I think we'll see about half the states in the country banning abortion, at least after 12 weeks, if not earlier.
All right. So just to be clear, I just want to back up just a little bit in terms of like what Roe effectively says. Mm-hmm. And that basically says that that abortion cannot be banned prior to 24 weeks. Is that determined? Like who makes that determination, the 24 weeks?
So the scientific community and the medical community have sort of settled on 24 weeks as the baseline for when a fetus can survive outside the womb with extreme medical intervention, of course. And there are very rare cases of very, very premature babies surviving at that point. But the reality is that many, if not most, pregnancies that are delivered at 24 weeks, that they're not going to survive. Nonetheless, that is considered to be the kind of starting point of potential viability.
And how is the, in an individual's instance, what are the mechanisms in which the state would be aware? And this is coming into play in the context of Texas right now, and it would conceivably come into context, you know, 15 weeks out. What is the mechanism in which the state is aware that someone has had an abortion prior to or following 24 weeks or 12 weeks or whatever it is? Like, I mean, what is the mechanics of that?
Do you mean like forcing them to go to a doctor and having them examined or something like that?
Yeah, the doctor must testify as to and certify that it's 24 weeks as opposed to 23 and a half or, you know, 6 weeks as opposed to this. Like, I mean, how exactly does that work? Because I want people to have a notion of just like how intrusive this is going to be. When we hear so much about we don't want to get between a doctor and their patient, this is like we're going to have this is exactly what this is, right?
Right. So the first thing to note here is that there are actually a lot of states that currently ban abortion before viability, and reproductive rights advocates are too scared of the Supreme Court to challenge them. But a number of states, including Texas, already ban abortion at 20 weeks, which is before viability. In every state with these severe abortion restrictions, there are ultrasound requirements and putative. These ultrasounds are supposed to help to confirm that the pregnancy is still at a stage that is early enough to be legal. Also, they are designed to force the patient to try to change her mind. In some states, the doctor is required to amplify the noises of the fetus. really loud so that the woman cannot drown them out by covering her ears or making noises. So the woman has to sit there and listen to the sounds of a fetus. And those sounds are usually obtained with a transvaginal ultrasound. A traditional ultrasound isn't going to get that amount of detail. So it's really a probe inserted into the patient's vagina. And then she's forced to sit there and watch and listen as the sounds and images of her pre-viability pregnancy are blasted to her.
And we should be clear that when we're talking about, you know, at least in Texas, we're talking about the supposed fetal heartbeat. At 6 weeks, it is not a fetus. It is still an embryo. There is no heartbeat because there is no heart at that point. There is a sort of like the beginnings of a formation of like an intersection, essentially, in the body. And what it is, it is an interpretation of this machine of electrical impulses. You cannot hear it with a naked ear, even if you were somehow to put your, you know, head inside of you know, someone's stomach and put it up there. There is no heartbeat.
Right. And there's this line in a lot of anti-abortion briefs and arguments and legislation that we've had so many scientific developments since 1973, since Roe was decided, that we now know that fetuses are real people, that they develop really early, that they're capable of pain at very early weeks. And so because of that, the factual underpinnings of Roe have fallen and it has to be overturned. But that's really almost entirely nonsense. It's not true that we can scientifically determine whether a fetus is a human, right? And like you say, what anti-abortion advocates describe as human organs, things like a heart, are not recognizable in a six-week fetus or even long thereafter. A fetus in early development has just the rudimentary beginnings of what's going to become a full-fledged body. And so when Texas uses language like a heartbeat act, it's really a sleight of hand, kind of akin to the billboards I always saw growing up in Florida that said, "My heartbeat begins at 6 weeks. Don't kill me," with a picture of a fetus that was at least at 12 weeks.
So you mentioned that, you know, you believe that the Supreme Court is essentially going to whittle this down or do something that will effectively end abortion as the protections were laid out in Roe. I'm wondering what you predict those contours will be, because obviously what we're seeing in Texas is seen as the most extreme, but a lot of states are taking notes. And we're talking about a 6 week viability. Most women don't even know they're pregnant after 6 weeks. So it's an impossible standard, and it's nearly an entire ban. You know, they could try to, not no pun intended, split the baby in many ways, but essentially end abortion. There are a variety of ways they could go. I'd imagine they'd try to appear less extreme while still doing what they want to do ideologically.
So that's a real possibility. And you can imagine the Supreme Court saying, okay, we're moving back the line to 15 weeks. So Mississippi's law can stand, but Texas's law has to fall. But I don't think that the justices are going to do that, because really, once you've erased the viability line, it's hard to identify a clear factual and legal standard that cordons off some abortions as lawful and constitutional and the rest as able to be banned. The reason the court landed on viability and stuck to it for almost half a century is because it's relatively clear. And I don't see the five ultra-conservative justices taking all of the heat that they would take for eroding Roe v. Wade, you know, throwing the court's legitimacy into real question, setting off a political firestorm just to move the line back a few weeks. It doesn't seem to me like there's any appetite for that. And you see this reflected in almost all of the briefs on the anti-abortion side. In some cases where conservatives are looking for a win, you see a whole range of possibilities laid out in briefs where they say, well, you could do this or this or this. There's a more moderate option. There's a more extreme option. But here, all of the anti-abortion folks are singing the same tune. They say, don't just fiddle with the standard, just overturn Roe, because once you start fiddling with it, the whole thing collapses anyway. And I think that there's some logical consistency there that will be very appealing to the conservative majority.
All right, let's move on to another case that has the potential for impacting all sorts of other cases. And this deals with the what is known as Chevron deference. And the case is American Hospital Association versus Becerra. Will you tell us the broad sort of like facts in that case, and then we'll talk about the potential it has for impacting the Chevron doctrine?
Yeah. So first, I think we should just briefly explain what Chevron deference is, right? Okay. Because it's important to drill down on those details, as crazy and boring as it sounds to most people who think it's like a car commercial.
If anybody is listening to this show who thinks it's crazy and boring, I want them to leave now.
Okay, good. So here's what happens with our modern American political system. Congress is filled with non-experts who, when they manage to pass a law, do not generally put a lot of details in the law. For instance, when Congress passed the Clean Air Act, Congress didn't say you can have this many parts per million of mercury in air. Congress said, all right, EPA, you now have the job of determining how much mercury in the air is safe and then implementing regulations to keep us at or below that limit, right? And when the EPA responds with some kind of regulation, the courts will inevitably review it because companies like Chevron are going to challenge it. And the question then becomes, how much deference should the federal courts give to these agencies that are interpreting laws that are really broad and often genuinely ambiguous? And if you say that courts should give a lot of deference, then you're giving these agencies a lot of leeway to decide what they think is best in their experts' view. If you give them not a lot of deference, then you're basically saying that Congress has been legislating wrong for the last century, and that a ton of legislation, including the Clean Air Act, is just unenforceable because it's too vague. So moving back to, oh yeah, Sam?
Let me ask you one more question in terms of like, so we have the Chevron deference, and this comes out of this Chevron versus Natural Resources Defense Council. This is from a case in the 80s, which essentially says that the courts must defer to the expertise of the EPA, the FDA, the whatever the agency is. What's the difference between that and the delegation doctrine, like the idea of the non-delegation doctrine? I mean, like there's a subtle difference between these two.
Yeah, so they're fundamentally intertwined, but you can think of Chevron deference as more of an issue with just statutory interpretation. Here are the words, what do they mean? And you can think of non-delegation as a broader constitutional idea. Whatever the words mean, does the Constitution allow that? And so the idea behind non-delegation is that Congress cannot, under the Constitution, give agencies a lot of leeway to interpret and enforce broad legislation, because that involves delegating the legislative power to these agencies that are part of the executive branch. So people like Neil Gorsuch say, you know what? When Congress wants to keep mercury out of the air, Congress has got to say exactly how many parts per million we're allowed to have, and it has got to say exactly how we're going to enforce that. Congress can't just kick it to the EPA, because the job of legislating falls only to Congress, and administrative agencies don't get to do it. So even if we applied Chevron deference, it doesn't matter, because this delegation is unconstitutional.
Okay. And so just to be clear, the Chevron deference is the relationship between the court and the agency on some level. And the non-delegation principle is the court assessing the relationship between Congress and the agency.
Yes.
And we should say, like, you know, people should just sit with this for a moment, because we don't know, like, when you test your water, for instance, if you have a well, you don't say the testing company has a list of 12 known, maybe it's more than that, but 12 known carcinogens or toxins that could be in your water. There's no way to say, like, look for blankety blank, which we don't know, because maybe there's some fracker down the road that's pumping stuff in there that's a trade secret. We don't even know what it is. Like, there's no way for Congress to ever not delegate. And if you are essentially delegating the authority to people who have been assembled to be experts, who should have the deference in that moment? The experts or the court? When it just comes to the actual sort of like material scientific questions, and that's what is going on here, there's no way to do it any other way, is my point. And yet we're looking at the end of that ability for lawmakers to use.
Yes. And so this is a case to go back to this case on the docket right now, American Hospital Association I think right now it's Becerra. This is a very confusing and boring and technical case about reimbursement rates paid by Medicare for particular outpatient drugs and exactly how that reimbursement rate is set. And so the question is whether HHS, the Department of Health and Human Services, can have its expert look at all of the facts and look at the statutory language and figure out what the right reimbursement rate is and have some respect for that in the courts, or whether the Supreme Court justices should take out their calculators and their pencils and decide that for HHS and say whether or not they got it right. And I just want to add one more layer on top of what you were saying earlier. Federal courts are accountable to no one, and we're learning that now in a very brutal way, right? Conservatives like to say that agencies are accountable to no one as well, that they're unelected bureaucrats. That's not really true. Agencies are created by Congress. Congress can easily pass new legislation to rein them in or abolish them or change them. And their leaders are appointed by the president and generally confirmed by the Senate. When the president leaves, agency personnel changes over. The new guy comes in. He gets to put his people in. They get to enforce the rules and change the rules if they want to. So no, agencies aren't the most democratic feature of our system, but they are much more accountable to the actual people, the voters, than federal judges who want to sit there with their calculators and their pencils and say what the real rule should be.
Okay, so putting aside the intricacies of the Medicare reimbursement rates, because this is the real issue in this case is going to be not so much what the Medicare reimbursement rates are, but whether the agency tasked with establishing those has the right to establish those. And then that principle, if they find that the agency doesn't have the right to do that, we are off to the races. Will you just like give us a sense of like what that means in a material, tangible way? I mean, we could lose. Theoretically, it seems to me we could lose our entire regulatory state for the most part.
All of it. And this has always been the goal, right? The goal of the non-delegation people and the anti-Chevron deference people is not to like nibble around the edges of a small set of regulations. It's to tear down the administrative state. And you see this in writings of, again, justices like Neil Gorsuch, who cares a lot about this, where he just openly smears these agencies and their personnel as like beady-eyed bureaucrats in the basement of government buildings doing unaccountable work. So, you know, go back to my mercury example. The EPA doesn't get any more deference there. Then we could see mercury rates shoot up and the EPA will be powerless to stop it. And so will Congress, unless we abolish the filibuster, which we're not going to, right? Okay. But, you know, if we can sneak a mercury rider into the debt ceiling legislation, it would make me happier. Think about overtime standards, basic fair labor stuff that's implemented by the Department of Labor. All of that is Chevron deference, right? All of that is delegated. Each new president comes in, puts their people in Department of Labor, and they figure out what's fair. Same deal with the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, rules about payday lending. Same deal with every agency you can think of, the Department of Education, when it's trying to stop sexual assault on campus, when it's trying to set minimal standards. Think about, you know, I could just go down the list of agencies, the Department of Energy, the Department of Commerce. These agencies exert immense influence over our lives, interpreting really broad statutes that are designed to give them leeway. And if those statutes are sort of ripped out from under them, if the carpet is pulled out from under these agencies, they won't be able to do anything. And the federal regulatory structure will collapse on itself.
I mean, that's why like these type of cases to me are so crucial for people to understand, and they are so obscured in many ways, right? I mean, like you're explaining this to us and you're feeling like you have to apologize. Yet it is what like make sure that we have, you know, some constraints on what happens in meat processing plants so that we're not getting, you know, if you haven't said specifically what type of animal feces we want to keep out of there, you know, well, you know, the Congress never said orangutan feces and just didn't contemplate that there could be. Go back and fix it. I mean, right. This is going to affect our health, our safety. It's going to affect our workers' rights. It's going to affect our consumer rights. It's going to affect our ability to, I don't know, have Medicare not pay exorbitant rates for things. I mean, this is going to affect every aspect of our lives, and it's going to be completely obscured from your average American.
People don't understand it. You need to kind of understand this baseline legalese where it's like non-delegation just to wrap your head around what's going on. And I think that's the genius of this particular conservative crusade. It's hard for normal people to understand. And so they can't make the connection between federal judges and their food poisoning that they got because OSHA wasn't allowed to regulate their workplace sandwiches anymore. And it's an issue. It might be an issue with the vaccine mandate as well. OSHA is interpreting a really broad statute that gives it sweeping authority to implement these kind of workplace safety rules. We don't know if the courts will grant it deference. If not, that vaccine mandate may fall.
And it's really just, I mean, is this the only case that they have on the docket as of yet to address this? I mean, when they start there, and there's been cases in the past, at least in the recent past, where there's been dicta, at least, that has sort of hinted at various of the ones of these conservative justices having a skepticism to this idea that, like, we can have almost an administrative state that has any type of, I guess, role in making granular decisions.
Yes.
And so, like, how do you expect this to go? Like, let me put it this way. It seems impossible to me, short of a couple of people getting hit by a bus, that the Chevron deference or the non-delegation authority is going to be in existence, let's say, 4 years from now. But it could come 6 weeks from now. It could come, right? I mean, like, how do you anticipate them going about this? Are they going to slice and dice this, or are they just going to hack it off like you're assuming they're going to do with Roe v. Wade?
So I feel professionally obligated to say I don't want anyone getting hit by a bus. We're just talking law here. But, you know,
it's a hypothetical.
the way, just a hypothetical. But the way that I think it will work is that the court will refuse to grant Chevron deference in this particular case and come up with some reasons that are silly, but give it an excuse, and then add a bunch of language dicta that is non-binding, but that says, by the way, the signatories of this opinion think that Chevron deference is bad and in an appropriate case should be overruled. That gives the high sign to conservative litigators who are pressing a bunch of Chevron-related cases in the lower courts right now. You see a flood of cert petitions rise up to the Supreme Court, and then the justices take their pick. They use one as a vehicle to overturn Chevron deference, and by June of 2023, it's gone completely.
It's so twisted, but it's basically they're going to use these cases to basically hone in on what should be brought to them and what the pivotal sort of issues and the fulcrum of that decision will be so that we can really knock this out. They're basically saying, this is the target we need. We need it right. This size. We need these colors in it, and we need to be this far away from it when we, you know, when we aim and fire. And that's basically.
And then when they do overturn it, they say, well, what are you guys complaining about? If you're angry about this, we've warned you we were going to do this for years. You know, we've been crapping on Chevron deference in our opinions forever. And the gaslighting continues.
All right. Let's talk about gun control. We should say that for the vast majority of this country's history, I mean, it's even almost understating it, up until 2008, the Supreme Court had observed, I think starting from like the 1930s, I think it was, essentially that that the Second Amendment was about militias. And then in 2008, I think it was, in the Heller case, sort of, I don't know, 180, 45 degree, 90. I don't know what the degrees would be, but no, this is about the right for individuals to carry. And what is happening with New York State Rifle and Pistol Association versus Bruen?
So for 13 years since Heller came down in 2008, pro-gun advocates have wanted to expand that decision to guarantee a right to carry guns in public. Heller's language is actually fairly limited. The phrase "in the home" is repeated throughout. The court says the Second Amendment confers an individual right to keep a handgun in the home. And so lower courts have generally, though not always, held that you don't have a right to take that gun out of the home and carry it with you on the streets. This will be the case to hold that. For a long time, when Kennedy and then Roberts were the swing votes, the court turned away these cases. But now that Kavanaugh is the median vote, and Kavanaugh is very, very pro-gun, the court has taken up this case. And it seems very likely that the court will essentially strike down New York's prohibition on concealed carry, require the state to license anyone who wants to carry a concealed weapon in public to do so as long as they don't have a criminal record. And in the process, also strike down laws in, I think, about 9 other states, including California, that currently prohibit or strictly limit concealed carry of weapons in public.
I mean, super excited to have a lot of armed people walking around in New York City.
You know, it's unfortunate for many reasons, but one is that some public defenders have actually joined this case and sided against the state and with the gun owners. And it caused a little bit of a stir. And they argue that this law allows New York police officers to harass and intimidate racial minorities on the suspicion that they're carrying a firearm. I guess 2 points I want to make about that. First, the police will continue to do that because it's the NYPD and the police face no real consequences. But second, you know, there are a lot of studies that show that New York's law is working to save lives, and in particular, working to save Black lives. There is a study that shows that New York's concealed carry ban lowers the death rate, the fatality rate among adult Black men in the state. And so I think it's unfortunate that this is being pitted as a kind of racial justice issue by the public defenders when there are definitely at least 2 sides to it, right? I mean, even if the law is allowing police brutality, which is bad and should not happen, it's also saving lives. And I'm not sure that the answer to that is just to have unelected judges step in and rule for one side and withdraw from the state the ability to limit concealed carry.
Yeah, it is. I've looked into that, and it's really vexing and disturbing in that regard. And I don't know. It seems to me like that's a pretty it's hard to imagine that this court not essentially blowing out any of these restrictions on carrying in public.
Yeah, I think that's the direction we're headed. And I think if it's concealed carry this time, it'll be open carry next time. There's a case coming out of the 9th Circuit where all of the conservatives said that you have a constitutional right to publicly carry a weapon in public where everyone can see it, including an assault rifle.
God, it is going to be so messed up to walk down the streets of New York City. And, you know, every now and then,
I'm hoping, is there any hope here? Or are we, like, we're talking about, like, scenarios that until, you know, we talk this through, I hadn't necessarily begun to contemplate.
I mean, I think there's a general consensus that this court is going to grant a constitutional right to concealed carry. I think the only question after that is whether they extend it to, like, open carry. I suppose we could see Kavanaugh changing his mind because he doesn't want his kids to see AR-15s when they're shopping at Kroger. But I have to say, like, this was what Mitch McConnell and Donald Trump were doing all of those years when they weren't passing any legislation, right? They passed one major bill under Trump. They passed a tax cut bill. What were they doing all the rest of the time? Appointing and confirming judges, because they knew that those judges would implement the GOP policies that are too unpopular to pass legislatively. Republicans have been pushing a nationwide concealed carry bill for years. It has never gotten the requisite number of votes. It's not very popular legislation, but that doesn't matter anymore because Trump was able to put these Federalist Society judges on the bench. Senate Republicans confirmed them. And now they're just going to implement that bill that was too unpopular to pass democratically. It's something that many of us were screaming about, I know, including the Majority Report during during Trump's tenure. And I guess the only real solution, Emma, is something like court expansion and court reform that dilutes the impact of these very, very far right Republican appointed justices.
There are other cases, but I think those are the three, at least the most prominent, and we'll have you back on to talk others. But let me, I want to ask you this question, and the Biden administration, from what I understand, is a lot more attuned to this problem than the Obama administration was, and is putting as many courts, many justices on the court as they can at this point. There's a limited amount you can, because there's not as many vacancies as there was during going into the Trump administration. And the Democrats may not control the Senate in I guess, 12 months, 14 months. But what is there a dynamic that's going on with all the federal judges that Trump was able to appoint? Circuit judges, I mean, in the appellate courts. And maybe, I guess, even in the district courts, that the path to these cases for the Supreme Court, the route to there is just easier than it has been in the past. Like, will you just explain? We just have a couple minutes. Will you just explain that dynamic? Because people just assume that these cases come up in the course of, you know, life, but that's not the way it works with these.
Yeah, and I think that the abortion case this term is a great example. This is a 15-week ban. The Court of Appeals should have issued a one-page decision saying this violates Roe, therefore it is blocked. Instead, Judge James Ho, who is arguably Trump's single worst judicial nominee across all of the courts, decided to write this opinion that demanded that the Supreme Court use this case to overturn Roe v. Wade, wrote essentially his own brief, like he was an advocate lobbying the conservative justices to seize on this case to overturn Roe. And that gives conservative lawyers so much power because they can take that and put it front and center in their appeal to the Supreme Court and say, look, the lower courts are desperate for you to take this case. They have sent the clearest smoke signal that they can. And this is happening all around. You are seeing conservative Trump judges writing opinions against, say, trans rights, against environmental regulations, against LGBTQ equality and more other contexts and all the other stuff we've been talking about, where they are advocating for the Supreme Court to overturn precedent and rule for them and use this particular case to do it. And I think that does create a dynamic where those cases go to the very top of the pile. They get attention at the Supreme Court and the conservative majority looks at them and looks at them very favorably. You never had that dynamic with liberals ever. They just don't act like that. I mean, we shouldn't even call them liberal judges, right? Our liberal judges are basically centrist judges. How many judges used to be across the political spectrum? These guys are a new breed, and they are not shy about using all of their power and influence to try to rocket very controversial cases straight up to SCOTUS.
Mark Joseph Stern, thank you.
Jesus.
Sorry to be the harbinger of doom once again, but that's my role these days, and I guess I just have to live with it.
It's like we've been seeing this train come down the tracks, and at one point it ends up being right in front of your face.
We're gonna call you Dr. Doom for your next your next appearance.
Appreciate your spending the time with us.
Always a pleasure. Thanks, Sam. Thanks, Emma.
Thanks, Mark.
All right, folks, going to take a quick break. Be right back. Wrap things up. All right. If you're watching us on Peacock, we will say adieu.
Adieu.
Okay. We'll see you tomorrow. Same time, I guess. I don't know what's happening.
It's underwater friends.
I think Mark Joseph Stern broke all our brains.
I was trying desperately to get us a little bit of laughter,
a little levity.
I felt like I was saying in the break. I felt like I was going to cry like two or three times. Holy moly, that was depressing.
Well, I don't know if the Peacock people are still with us, but we'll see you tomorrow.
Whoa, right? I thought we did officially break.
I don't know. Yeah, they'll figure it out. They'll figure it out.
And I'm sure they'll appreciate.
The French.
Yeah. Well, I'm cultured.
I mean,
can't people tell I speak?
Maybe they'll be. Maybe
French.
We could put that in the tags, so the search terms on the Peacock app, so they can just look for French speaking and get to us. I actually took a. I don't know if I want to go into this.
Do it.
I took a. I just saw somebody promote the appearance that they did on the other show that we do on Peacock.
Mm-hmm.
And they put a link up, and just for shits and giggles, I knew how this was going to go. I put on my recording on my phone, and I clicked the link to see how many steps it took me to actually get to the interview that they were purportedly linking to.
Mm-hmm.
And
how many steps?
Let me put it this way. It is easier for me to fill out the health screening form for my son to get into school every day, establishing the exact exposures he's had on three different pages to COVID to get him into school every day. That takes a couple of minutes. So, I mean, it's really, you got to really want to see that clip.
Mm-hmm.
And then even then, there's no guarantee, because it really doesn't actually take you to anything. So, whatever. That's just, you know, technology.
Technology, right?
They still haven't quite figured that out yet.
Yeah, some...
Links.
Some technology is easy. Others, it's hard.
Folks! I'm just, like, sort of fighting between this sort of... we're finally here at the 6-3 Supreme Court, which, you know... long-time listeners of this show know that,
never going to happen.
We were warning about this in the summer of 2016.
Yeah.
Like I say, you see the train leave the station. You're on the plains of the, I don't know, you're in Nebraska, and you could see the train leaving from miles and miles away, that smokestack. I mean, I guess I'd never seen a train with a smokestack, but I'm just imagining if back in the day, look, Ma, the train's coming. It'll be here in half a day. Like, you could see it. You know what I mean? And it's just, you could just see it coming. And here we're here now. And I
you're ruled by fear, Sam. By the way, do you hear this crazy stuff about the vaccines? I don't know. I feel a little bit weird about it now.
God.
I like how your only perception of trains are from the Lone Ranger.
Well, I don't know other contexts where you can see a train from that kind of distance. You know what I mean?
You see trains from a distance in North Dakota.
Or North Dakota. Okay, I could have said North Dakota as opposed to Nebraska. But... You can only see the train from a distance. Like
they don't let the big smoke off anymore, though.
That's right. Right. That's my point.
Right. They're not the.
I'm just using the analogy as a way of like trying to mediate the reality, so that the reality is just not that painful.
Yeah. Until the reality, aka the train, hits you and runs you over.
I mean, it's happening. I mean, we can see what's going on in Texas. That is a brief preview as to what's going to happen around the country. I mean, they're not going to have to do those hinky dink. We're deputizing lunatics to use civil procedure as a way of doing this. We can just do it now. We can just do it now. We'll just, they're gonna, you know, hook up the ultrasounds to the same sort of mechanism they have for when they do car inspections, and you know, to make sure that your catalytic converter is working. I mean, that's basically it.
Yeah, I mean, and it's the artificial noise. And it's not artificial, I guess. Amplified noise of the baby in your uterus. Like, I'm sure if you amplify the noise of other ways in which your organs are moving about, it might not be the best.
But it's not even an amplification. I mean, let's be clear. It is.
I mean, he said he turns it up like really, really loud so women can't cover their ears.
That's the amplification, but it's not. You're not. When you're at 6 weeks, you're not hearing a noise that is coming from your body. You are hearing the translation of an electrical impulse into a noise, which is different. The sound does not exist without it going through this machine.
It's like the beep, beep, beep of an EKG machine, but like,
right.
That's there, not
your,
actually,
your
that's
heart
not
is
what your heart sounds.
Your heart does not go beep, beep, beep. That's exactly right. All right. Folks, this show relies on your support. You can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only help this show survive and thrive, but you also get extra content virtually every day. Mm. You know, I'm only saying virtually because I know that there's a Indigenous People Day is coming up. Is it a week from yesterday? I don't know. Monday. And so we're willing to do a first half of the show. But look at how scrupulous I am by that. Like, I mean, that takes like that the idea that we're going to be doing that one non fun half a show has been like dogging my ability to say you get extra content every day for like months. I've seen that coming.
Because you're just anticipating the one day that there won't be extra content.
Yeah.
Right. You can't lie about it. One day there won't be extra content, but that doesn't mean that the extra content from the other days isn't worth a membership.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I solved that moral quandary for you.
I appreciate that. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. And join our Discord, majoritydiscord.com. Subscribe and like our YouTube videos. Poggers. Get a hype train going. Do all that stuff.
Choo choo.
What's in that? What's in that thing?
You know what it is on hump day.
Yeah.
Absinthe.
Oh my God. Matt, what's happening in the Matt Lekkian media universe?
First, I just had an image of somebody hooking up like their fetus to like an orange amplifier guitar.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, right.
Put it through a fuzz there, pedal.
That is
incidentally,
that's actually
not even a fetus.
That's how Nirvana recorded.
It's an embryo until like week 10 or 11.
How Nirvana recorded in utero.
Hook my embryo up to a Vox AC-15. Tonight on Left Reckoning, Cale Brooks of Jacobin Video Editor joined us to talk about NGOs. We'll also be talking about, in the post game, Dave Rubin breaks down the Facebook whistleblower in a way that I think is very instructive for where we have some convergence and divergence with the right on this issue. And we'll also be talking about all the right-wingers coming to the defense of Kristen Sinema. That's patreon.com. Just left.
That's weird.
To get access to the postgame, it is weird. It's also like one of the reasons to like having Dems in power, because these sorts of things start showing themselves, as opposed to, say, Kristen Sinema acting like she's one of us.
Right. Right. I agree.
But so yeah, patreon.com. Just left reckoning. That's 8/7 central tonight on YouTube.
Also, don't forget, check out Nomi Show, youtube.com/TheNomiKeyShow. You can find that at youtube.com/TheNomiKeyShow or twitch.tv/the_NomiKey_show.
Wow.
See you in the fun half. 646-257-3920.
Talk about a hype train.
Yeah, exactly. I'm for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it, you might throw.
Alpha males are back, back. Back, back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back, back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare!
Nightmare!
Bring back DJ
Denner. Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Denner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them, fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back, 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 back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keeping it 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them. Fuck them. Things I do for the bigger game plan. By the way, it's my birthday. Happy birthday to me, Jew boy.
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back.
Come on. To pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total pussy.